The following program is a Zygon International audio presentation.
Everyone is a creature of myth. The ancient legends and tales of the race are still the master keys to the human psyche. Mythology reveals humanity's deepest longings, fears, sorrows, joys, and hopes. If we are to understand ourselves, we have to know our myths. For the past half century, Joseph Campbell, Professor Emeritus of Sarah Lawrence College, has been a dedicated student and teacher of mythology. More than any other single individual, he has brought mythology into the mainstream of American thought through his prolific works, including the classic four-volume work entitled The Masks of God, the best-selling Hero with a Thousand Faces, The Mythic Image, and Myths to Live By. He has edited numerous works, including Philosophies of India, The Portable Jung, and The Portable Arabian Nights. At 80 years of age, Joseph Campbell is still moving as fast as when he won gold medals for the Columbia track team. In the fall of 1983, Harper & Row released his The Way of the Animal Powers, the first volume of a four-volume historical atlas of world mythology. As a child, Joe Campbell saw Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and visited the Totem Room at the Museum of Natural History in New York City. From these small yet powerful beginnings, Joseph Campbell's life's work began. Our lives are the richer for it. Join us for the next hour as we plumb the depths of mythic lore with the master himself, Joseph Campbell. My name is Michael Toms. I'll be your host. Joseph, welcome.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's always a real delight to me to have our conversations here at this station.
Well, surely it's a delight to me as well. Joseph, beyond the Buffalo Bill's Wild West show and the Totem Room at the Museum of Natural History, how did you really become, beyond that, become interested in mythology and the study of mythology? What happened?
Well, I think I would have to put it back to having been brought up a Roman Catholic and taking it very, very seriously as a boy, and realizing as I was reading the American Indian myths that the same forms were appearing there in a totally different culture context. And very early, I became interested in this comparative realization. And then in my university years, I was specializing in literature of the Middle Ages, and there the Arthurian traditions, and back of that, of course, the classical mythologies. These brought forth the same images again in a context that was that of the Christian tradition and yet inflected toward the more universal point of view that is that of the comparative approach. So this was it.
Much of your work is focused on the East, the Orient, and Oriental philosophies and the spiritual traditions of
yes.
the Orient. How did you first become interested in that area?
Well, that happened when I was a student in Europe. Actually, I met on a steamer back, I think it was 1924, Jiddu Krishnamurti and Raja Gopal, his friend, and his brother Nityananda, who died the next year. And that was my first encounter with the Orient at all. And a young woman who was on the boat was associated with them, and she gave me a copy of Edwin Arnold's Light of Asia, which is the life of the Buddha, which was the first I ever heard of all this. And then when I went to Europe as a student, I started, after a year in Paris, discovering modern art as well as doing my research in medieval material. In Germany, I started Sanskrit and just became fascinated, that's all. And later then, long years later, after I had been teaching and writing, I met Heinrich Zimmer, who was a major Indologist. And at the time of his death, his widow asked me to edit his American lectures, and I went way deep into the Orient. I also was helping Swami Nityananda edit the translate out of Bengali the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, and I knew Kumaraswamy and his work, and so it was a big load, and it all just opened this material out into vast, vast reaches.
Going back to your study of Native American lore and One of the myths that come out of the Native American tradition is the myth of the vision quest. And I'm wondering how you would relate the vision quest to Christian mythology. What would be the counterpart in Christian mythology?
Well, it is the counterpart of the mystical approach. What might be called the Pentecostal point of view, that one, through one's own inward experience, experiences the divine mystery in the way of one's own culture references and possibilities. This is the wonderful thing, I think, about the American Indian tradition, that sense of a divine realization possible to everyone, and one's whole life then is based on the experience of that vision. Whether the young man was to become a great warrior or a shaman or a chieftain is revealed to him at that time. So one finds one's own way through one's own experience, a way in the world in which one's living.
Why is appreciating such a myth important and relevant to the times we live in today?
Well, what I feel about the American Indian material is that for Americans, it's very important to know something about it, because mythology is rooted in the land as well as in the psyche. And our mythology has been brought from the Near East a very long, long time ago. It was put together. And it does not relate to our land unless we can, through our own experience, make it relate. Do you see? And if you do not have that experience, then the Holy Land is somewhere else. But the great realization of mythology is the imminence of the divine here, now. You don't have to go anywhere else for it. This is the Holy Land, the holy place, the holy moment. And I think that's a basic Christian experience in the land where Christianity emerged. But then as an import somewhere else, all the images have been alien. Do you see what I mean? And to find the Christ power here is the goal of such a meditation.
In some sense, we have the Native American tradition being kind of the mythic image of the land. And then the land became settled by cultures and peoples from many other traditions and societies and social milieus, and bringing a lot of different myths to the pot, as it were. And how do you see that as happened in America? I know you've written and talked about the idea that myth has been lost to us. Do you think that had something to do with it, the fact that this melting pot of various traditions coming into America produced a kind of a hodgepodge, no-myth society?
Well, the founding myth of the United States was the Christian myth in one sectarian form or another. Every state in the Northeast was formed by a sect that departed from the one next door and set up its own affair. But these are all variants of the Christian tradition. And this was a tradition that saw the truth as uniquely present in Christianity, and there was an actual degradation and denial of the possibilities of anyone else having the tradition, so that the deities of the Indians and the divine experiences were regarded as diabolical manifestations. I mean, one gets this all the time. I think that was a terrible thing to have happened. It led to the extinction of the Native American cultures here. Also, you can see in our roads these ribbons of concrete running across the continent, and I've driven across the continent many, many times, and you just pass through it. You don't absorb it. And the people who have moved into it have on their own to establish a relationship to the ground. They don't have any tradition for it. Do you see? I think that the movement now of the sort of realizing the importance of the land and respect for the land and how you can't violate it without violating your own life is something that represents a return of a realization that this is our land and we have to love it and deal with it in its terms somehow. But it may be too late, I don't know.
What about all this we hear about the deterioration or the disappearance of the nuclear family, the loss of family roots, and kind of, again, the melting into society of individuals with no ties to their ancestral heritage.
Well, there you see where we are. We're between two worlds, a world that is dissolving right around us. Everything is dissolving right around us. And the one that's to come hasn't shown its features yet. There's one aspect that I think is showing itself as potential but not realized, and that is that we are members of the community of the Earth. I say it's one community. The economic intercommunications, the fact that I was yesterday in Hawaii, you know, and my wife Jean is now in New York, having left yesterday from Hawaii, and I'm here. Or we could have gone the other direction and been in Tokyo or Benares. We're in one world. And I can remember the experience teaching when I began to have in my classes youngsters from India, you know, from Japan, from the countries that when I was a boy were just out of sight. It is one family now. But no one has the nerve to say so, you know. One sees that people pulling back to their in-groups. We're the right ones, we're the right ones. And it's splitting not only in terms of nations and races, but also in terms of economic classes. And no one has a sense of participating in a great organization and organism, which is that of humanity on this planet. But that's the challenge of today. And since mythologies all have to do with linking these eternal forms, which are those of the psyche and of the mysteries of the universe, to the contemporary life situation, the new myth has to move into the one world system.
Joseph, you mentioned the reality that we have become one world community, but we're still failing to recognize it. And it just brings up the idea of the need for new myths, and certainly one of the new myths is the idea of community and the extension of family, and perhaps even the return to an old one, the tribal life, as it were, because in many respects we see communities emerging around the planet that do have kind of almost like a tribal life style to them. What about that?
Well, the problem is to realize you're a member of a small organism functioning as part of a large organism. And the problem of commitment of the smaller to the larger is the main one here, as I see it. The nation is something I think that is going to have to dissolve, but not the family unit. The family unit is an organic base. A lot of the crime, a lot of the troubles right now comes from the dissolution of the family. Everything's been thrown on the schools. We receive children who haven't learned how to behave decently as human beings, and it's supposed to be up to the school to inculcate ethics. That lies behind this whole prayer in the school problem. The prayer should be at home, not in the schools, because there are so many different prayer systems. And the fact that the children have to sit there and hear prayers recited to a deity who's not the name of the deity that is of their family, this I think is throwing the whole thing out of order. The family has to assume the responsibility, and I don't know how it can be brought about that people should feel that when they commit themselves to having children, it's their job also to take the responsibility that these grow up to be decent human beings.
So in some sense, what we're talking about is that kind of that in ages past, when a man's word was his bond and agreements were made verbally and not with extensive contracts, etc. It seems we've lost our understanding of integrity and ethics and values, and in many respects, that somehow our institutions have been inculcated with the institution is more powerful and more meaningful than human beings, and something has been lost in the process. And certainly, the mythic past has much to teach us in that respect, doesn't it?
Yes, but just primary human decency. I mean, something happened after the Second World War. It really did. And out of my own experience, which is simply that of the academic world, we couldn't keep books in the library. In a small college, the students are plundering the library, taking the books out. So now they've had to establish traps so that the book has some piece of metal in it or something. They walk through something, there's a buzz, here's a kid stealing a book. But the books I had to use for my course, for example, in comparative mythology, were often very difficult to get. And the librarian would get copies in, finally, and then next year we had to get new ones. The New York Public Library, I put in cards now for books, and, oh no, can't be found on the shelf. Or if I do get the book, the chapter I want has been ripped out by somebody. That never happened before. That never happened before. And this indicates a basic loss of a sense of the individual as a member of a community. It's, what have you done for me lately, you know?
And a disrespect for institutions.
And for themselves, yes. I would say. And for the person sitting beside them in the library. No, it's a very funny, strange thing, and it was in one generation that it happened.
Is it possible to recover?
I don't know. You know, when a house is broken, it's broken. In terms of that aspect of our situation, I'm pessimistic.
So as we look to the future, and we see ourselves in kind of a transitional society. Where do you think myth comes in a transitional society, which is kind of grasping at straws, as it were?
Well, myth comes in when you realize that the real judgment of life is not to be based on whether it's practical. The emphasis on practical, economic, and political ends leaves you without a ground, and the ground in the notion of what it is to be a decent and functioning and harmoniously put together human being. And it's that the myth has taught. I'm amazed reading some of these very, very, what we call primitive mythologies, at the sense of decency in the human being, in his relationship to other members of his community. Not the community outside, but his community. We've even lost that. So
what we're talking about is the idea that it's not enough to have a career and be successful monetarily in the world. There's more to life than that.
I think perhaps the economic emphasis, which is now very strong. For instance, in the colleges, the liberal arts departments are sinking, and everybody's going in for professional specialization, which does not tell you how to be a human being. It does not give you the rich information that comes through reading the classics, you know, Plato, Goethe, Shakespeare. Oh, what do we want with that, you know? What's the relevance? You know the term. And all this came in the 60s, as far as my experience goes.
Well, at the same time, there was a reemergence of the liberal arts in the 60s, but it kind of went by the boards in the last few years.
Well, I don't know what to say about the 60s. It was very politically oriented. There were two things that were going on there. One was blowing up the buildings on the campus, and the other was blowing up your own psyche with LSD. And there was a failure to experience the richness of things as they are, and also the privilege of living in this society, and knowing what it has given you, you know, in contrast to the others. If you've traveled around a little bit, you know what we've got. And this is something that can be lost. And they seem not to have realized that. I was terribly disgusted with the 60s. I was glad to get out. I never thought I'd be happy to retire from teaching, but I didn't like what was going on.
What do you see what's going on now? I mean, do you see that things have improved? Or
I'm not on the campus. I've been dealing with older people the past 12 years lecturing around, and this, to me, has been just beautiful.
But in many respects, the people that you work with in your workshops are people who came out of the 60s.
Yes, and they're trying to recover their humanity. That's it.
By coming to your workshops. That's one way. Yeah.
Really. There's a wonderful saying that a friend gave me to let you know you've reached that point in your life that's old. He said, you've got to the top of the ladder, and you found us against the wrong wall. Well, I've been dealing with people who found their ladders against the wrong wall, and everybody does. At a certain point, you realize there's another breakthrough to be made at this time. It's not that of the achievement of anything except an inward consciousness of my inward life and my relationship. And another thing that happens when you get to be a little older is you realize all the beauty you missed. I mean, that was a moment, that relationship with that person, and I didn't realize what it was. It goes on and on.
This recovery of one's internal depths, will that happen through the existing religious institutions or outside of saints?
Well, I think the religious institutions, as I have to say, they're so oriented to just, what can I say, social ethics as they understand it. And they see the devil as all over the place. I mean, I don't know any other tradition that has the devil in it to this extent. The formality of the religion instead of the experience of the divine within the other person over there, that's one of the wonderful things in the Orient. I mean, that greeting with the hands and the prayer gesture to the other person, that's a recognition of the divine power in that person. We don't see it in people. You know, we don't. And you do later on, you realize. I can tell you, that's the only regret I have in my life, that episodes and people and situations and moments of learning, I did not realize what the privilege was and what I was really not experiencing.
Well, there's a teaching in there for all of us, I think.
Yeah,
as we look at our lives.
Big point. And I think